Connecticut today for a very busy Friday, January 8th, 2021, wrapping up a crazy and hectic week. Co-author Tamara Payne joined us in the 3 o'clock hour. She and her father, a legendary newspaper man, Les Payne, just finished up a brand new biography of civil rights activist Malcolm X. That's getting quite the praise in the literary circles. 4:30 p.m., just after the news, we talked to Bill Dunlap, Quinnipiac University constitutional law professor, about the 25th Amendment and could it be used to remove President Trump from office. And then in the 5 o'clock hour, author and legal scholar John Feerick, a section of a chat I did with him back in June. He was promoting a new book, but John Feerick is one of the gentlemen who actually wrote the 25th Amendment. All right, we're 203-333-9422, 203-333-WICC. We're going to put the calls on hold for a few minutes. Fascinating guests coming up. Can you imagine spending 30 years doing something on one goal? People have done it, you know, in a career thing, but imagine working for 30 years on a project. Well, the name of the project is The Dead Are Arising, The Life of Malcolm X. It's a new biography of Malcolm X by Pulitzer Prize winning a newspaper man who also grew up for part of his life here in Connecticut, Les Payne. You may remember Les, especially for you folks listening on Long Island who wrote for Newsday for years. Les Payne spent the better part of 30 years on this book. He passed away in 2018, but his daughter Tamara helped finish it. It is now out, and this book is getting rave reviews, and that is an understatement. So to talk about the book and the effort that she put in to finish her father's work, Tamara Payne joins us right here on WICC. Tamara, Paul here in Bridgeport, Connecticut. How are you?
Hi, Paul. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. Your dad put 30 years of an effort into this. There had been numerous books, Tamara, of course, written about the civil rights icon Malcolm X. Why did your dad choose to make an effort like this? What was his reasoning behind this?
Well, first, he didn't intend to work on it for so long, but as a journalist, his interest was finding something new and interesting and a story to tell. And he found that in learning when he met Malcolm's brothers back in 1990. He met him through a friend of his, Walter Evans, who also grew up in Hartford, and they stayed in touch. They were like best friends, and so he was out in Detroit, and he was a surgeon in Detroit, and he had, it was at a party. He introduced my father to one of the brothers. My father was fascinated because Dad admired Malcolm, and as a journalist and as a columnist, Rook had written about Malcolm, would write about him a couple of times a year. Usually around his assassination day and also his birthday. But he had the opportunity to meet with one of the brothers and interviewed him, and he just was fascinated by learning about Malcolm's childhood and their family life with their parents. And he came back to New York and met with another colleague here in New York named Gil Noble, who's also a journalist and also fellow admirer of Malcolm X. And he said, well, which brother did you speak to? And my father told him it was Filbert, who's only a couple of years older than Malcolm, and Gil Noble told him that he should speak with Wilfred. So Dad went back to Detroit to meet Wilfred, and Wilfred agreed to sit down with Dad. And Dad interviewed both of these brothers that first time, each of them, 8 hours each. And Wilfred, who was older than Malcolm by 6 years and also Malcolm's best friend and confidant, for all of his life. So they were very close, and they kind of give you this kind of brackets of, you know, Malcolm coming from the older perspective, but either being closer in age and also seeing him from, you know, when you're 6 years old, you remember when your sibling is born, and not necessarily when you're 2 years, but definitely when you're 6 years older. And, you know, and he was just fascinated by what he learned about their family life, about how the mother, you know, how the parents were Garveyites, and they were organizing families wherever they lived, whether it was in Omaha, Nebraska, Lansing, and Milwaukee, organizing black families under with the Garveyite principles of building their business, is embracing who they are as Black people and thriving, and you know, and being independent minded and supporting each other. And so this is what, you know, the parents were operating under. They were helping other Black people achieve this, and they, this was the talk in their household. This is how they raised their children and this pride. And their mother, I mean, the mother was, you know, she had more education than the than their father, Earl Sr. She would sing to them in French. She would teach them their lessons. She was a grammarian. She, you know, she was heavy on making sure they understood, they knew how to write.
Mm-hmm.
And their father, you know, he was a hard worker. He imbued a strong work ethic in their children, along with this pride. You know, they lived on farms, so he actually organized his neighbors, their neighbors, to share their crops and market them. In addition to everything that else he was doing, and having all the children with their chores and all of that. So this is a sense of Malcolm and growing up that we don't know and how it impacts him. But then the environment.
Yeah, and I'm sure that your dad was fascinated by that. Tamara, hang on. We're going to get much more into this. I got to do a quick break. The guest is Tamara Payne. She and her dad, Les Payne, putting out The Dead Are Rising, The Life of Malcolm X, a biography of Malcolm X. And you may think, folks, well, there's, you know, the autobiography of Malcolm X, the one that everybody has read or heard about from the late, great Alex Haley, numerous other books. But this book is getting just rave reviews, excellent reviews. Whether you hold Malcolm X in high regard or not, whether you agree with what he said or not, it is a fascinating read. More with Tamara Payne coming up. Traffic and Weather Together, 3:36 on WICC. And we continue with Tamara Payne. The new book is The Dead Are Arising, The Life of Malcolm X. Once again, if you want to check it out, go to Amazon, wherever you get your books. The Dead Are Arising, The Life of Malcolm X, written by Les Payne, the late, great newspaper writer. Again, if you're listening to us on Long Island, you probably remember Les Payne for years, a New York centric newspaper writer, and he and his daughter Tamara collaborating on this, and Tamara finishing it after her dad passed away. You know, Tamara, I was looking at some of the reviews of the book, and it's interesting. One of them says that it depicts Malcolm X as a human being, or goes into the human side of this guy. We all know the fiery speeches. We all know the phrase, by any means necessary. We all know the controversy around the assassination. But do you think that's one of the strong points of this book, is it gets in to Malcolm as who he was as a person?
Examination of Malcolm as a person in the context of his family, but also in the context of the world he was born into. We opened the book with the Klan riding in on the little family home in Omaha, Nebraska. And this is a few years after the great incident, the lynching incident in Omaha, Nebraska, where Will Brown was lynched in 1919. And, you know, Omaha, Nebraska is still feeling reverberations. And one of them is, you know, the Klan riding to the family's home to threaten them and get them to leave town because they don't want them organizing other Black families.
So that really was one of the formative events in his early life, correct?
Malcolm was not born yet. His mother Louise was pregnant with him.
Yeah.
But Wilfred recounts that, Wilfred and Philbin, but Wilfred more so recounts that incident for us. And we opened the book with that, and it just really opens the picture in the middle of the action of this is the world that Malcolm's being born into.
Yeah, so in other words, when he learned about this, though, I would assume, Tamara, after he was born and he learned about this, that must have really affected him, though.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, his view is of the Klan, for example, that there's nothing good to be have in a relationship with the Klan. You know, for the threats, I mean, also his, you know, his belief that the Klan had killed his father.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as we know in the book, too, that he is charged with meeting with the Klan by the Elijah Muhammad, who's the head of the organization. I mean, he doesn't want to have a meeting in a sense of, you know, having an agreement with the Klan, but he wants to have more of a confrontation with the Klan when that happens. But yes, this incident definitely is it sets the framework for his view on the Klan.
Now he
and it never leaves.
Yeah, and he spent, a lot of people may not know, he spent time in jail. He did jail time, but the conversion or the introduction to Islam, it's not unusual, Tamara, to read that about how many folks in the past, even in the present, they are in prison or they're in a different part of their life, and then all of a sudden it's an initiation to some religion or something spiritual that kind of flips a switch in them.
Right, but what's also flipping a switch in Malcolm at that time is before he is introduced to the Nation of Islam in prison, he's already, he's in that crime spree and he's trying to pivot out of that. He doesn't want to spend the rest of his life in jail. That's not how he saw his life and certainly not how his family saw his life. So he's taking up the advantage of the opportunity and his exposure to books in there, to people who've read those books. He's developed his debating skills, and he's reading everything he can. And so he's already opening up his mind and moving away from being so rambunctious. And I think it's really also important to understand where he is age-wise at his life. He was 20 years old when he went into prison. And so when we also talk about that crime spree, he was a teenager, you know, and hustling. And we also have to look at what other people were doing at that time. Because this is, you know, when you're talking about the late 30s and early 40s, but the late 30s is also the end of, we're talking about the end of the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. But he's also young. A lot of people are suffering. People are trying to make ends meet. He does this. And now he wants to, you know, turn his life around. And the other thing to understand is that it's also important to see that his family is right there with him. It is Wilfred who joined the Nation first and brings all of his siblings into the Nation because of he's attracted to the Garveyite teachings that he finds, not teaching so much, but their practices, for building up their own schools to educate their children and building up their business and supporting each other. And Wilfred was very attracted to that. It resonated with him. And so he joins and he knows that he and his family can grow with this. Mm-hmm. And he wants Malcolm to do that. And he figured that, you know, once Malcolm comes out, he can grow with this too. And that's how Malcolm gets brought into it. We hear that Malcolm talks about how his family had been part of it. But here we see is really the details of how it was Wilfred who brought in and what it was, his beef with Elijah Muhammad early on. Wilfred, I mean, nobody really probably would think about his oldest brother meeting with Elijah Muhammad. And he also convinces Elijah Muhammad to talk and you know, allow Malcolm to write him letters, you know, and he was impressed. And when Malcolm comes out, you know, it is Wilfred who is encouraging Elijah Muhammad to meet with Malcolm. It's his family that puts him in, and he's already pivoting. It's something he can pivot away from, you know, being directionless and aggressive, but also to take all those energies and redirect and building something that will help.
Yeah, you're breaking up a little bit. Let me get a final question in with you, Tamara. If he was not assassinated, what do you think his legacy would have been? What would he have carried on, you think, to do in the area of race relations?
I think he would have continued. I mean, when he was assassinated, he was in the process of taking the work, the civil rights fight of Black people in America on internationally. I mean, he had traveled throughout Africa. He had made his Hajj. He had adopted Sunni Islam. And he was going to take this to the United Nations. But in order to do that, he needed foreign support from other governments. And he had spoken with other African governments to garner support for this, to bring up charges against the United States government for violating Black people's human rights in this country. And so I think he would have continued on that. And he would have, if you want to fast forward even, say he would have continued on that, and he was making headway, and this obviously was a threat. So, you know, people had been placed in and movement was made where he was assassinated. And we really played out the book brilliantly, and I really encourage the audience to buy the book to learn more about the history. I mean, it's important about this book is that it's the history of this country, of what's going on today, you can really see how we got to, how we are where we are from repeated not dealing with this tension, this the racism and white supremacy, not really fully dealing with this in the way that Malcolm was trying to deal with it. And Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement, they were dealing with it, but they're, you know, Malcolm's work in dealing, trying to overcome and bringing black people to confront this is not finished. But the rest of the country also has to deal with this too, as we saw what happened at the events this week. But I also want to say to your audience that Hartford plays an important role in this story.
Well, imagine,
And what was brilliant about that situation is that my father grew up in Hartford, as did Walter Evans. When we found out that Malcolm organized that temple and we met some of the founding members, and just learning about what it was like being, you know, and nobody had heard those stories before.
Let me ask you something, Tamara. We only have about a minute left, but I wanted to ask you in closing, were you surprised at how much of the story was over the years? I mean, we're talking about decades, was never really told. How surprised were you with that?
Well, I think we have to look at the times in 1965 when Malcolm was assassinated, a different time, and people, you know, it was shaken, just like people are shaken today, right? People were shaken, and, you know, and they had to figure out, what are we going to do now? And so they weren't necessarily talking about their stories with Malcolm. People who were working with Malcolm at that time, who may have known him, and they saw that happen to him, they kind of kept that to themselves after that, but they remembered, and he influenced them to the point that they never forgot him, and they had a lot of respect. They have a lot of respect for him. It is amazing that those stories weren't told, but it's also understandable.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm so happy that we were able to collect them and present them to the audience.
Well, that's great. The name of the book is "The Dead Are Arising." Once again, "The Dead Are Arising." It's about Malcolm X, the life of Malcolm X. A lot of people know about the Alex Haley book. This is the newest one, over 600 pages. It is getting rave reviews, written by the late Les Payne and his daughter Tamara Payne. Tamara, thank you for the time. We appreciate it. Good luck and Happy New Year.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
Appreciate it. All right, there you go. We'll get rid of some business here. Back to the phones at 2:00 next hour. Not this hour, but coming up next hour, I will go back. In fact, I did go back in the archives, and I remembered from a few months back in June, he had a new book out. I had John Feerick on the show, Fordham University law professor, a real law powerhouse in and about New York. He helped actually draft and write the 25th Amendment back in the mid-60s. This happened post the JFK assassination. So I'll be giving you that segment coming up next hour. But right now, a gentleman who can also speak to this, one of our legal eagles, we have him on here often, professor of law at Quinnipiac University, Bill Dunlap. He's been teaching constitutional, criminal, national security, counterterrorism, and international law since 1983. Bill, Paul here. How are you? Happy New Year. How are you?
Happy New Year to you.
The 25th Amendment, Bill, talk about what it actually says. What does it do? Was it intended for times like this? What are the machinations of this? What would have to happen here? And what's the time frame it could take?
The time frame is very flexible, but it's probably not going to allow it to be used this time. The 25th Amendment's been part of the Constitution since 1967, a few years after the Kennedy assassination, when we wound up with no vice president for a couple of years. So the Congress decided we needed to do something about this situation. So they not only drafted an amendment that called for the appointment of a new vice president when that position becomes vacant. It also dealt with several other issues dealing with vacant presidency. And the one that everybody is talking about today is Section 4, which allows a committee consisting of the vice president and a majority of the cabinet officers, or the vice president, and a group that is designated by Congress, which has never been designated. If that group informs the if it informs the Speaker of the House and the President pro tem of the Senate that the President is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, the Vice President immediately becomes the acting President, and the President no longer has any executive powers.
So in this case,
the President can fight that. But
yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, Bill, before we get to that, and I want to talk to you how he can fight that. So in this case, that incapacity or inability would likely be written up, I would assume, as a mental incapacity or inability, perhaps, correct?
Well, the Constitution isn't entirely clear on that. Hmm. It just says they have to declare that the President is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office. So it does not sound as though it's designed for even a situation where there is a serious, almost universal disagreement with what the President is doing. It looks as though it has to be, as you just suggested, a physical or mental disability. And all the times that a similar provision, one where the President can voluntarily cede his powers to the Vice President, all of those have been in times where the President was physically unable to do it. When President Reagan was shot and when George W. Bush went into the hospital twice for colonoscopies, they voluntarily handed this power over.
And you said that a President can fight this. How would they do that, Bill?
By filing a similar but opposite, I suppose, a declaration saying that he is able to discharge his duties, and eventually the matter will wind up going to Congress, which has to make a decision. If Congress agrees with the Vice President and the committee by a two-thirds margin in both houses, then the Vice President will remain the acting President. But if Congress does not do that, if Congress doesn't act, or if Congress acts but fails to get the two-thirds margin, then the President will resume his powers.
Bill, hang on. We'll be right back to you. Fascinating stuff. We have him on often to try and make sense of all this. Quinnipiac University Professor of Law, Bill Dunlap, and as he mentioned there, one of his areas of expertise, national security and the Constitution. Traffic and weather together at 4:36 on WICC. And we are going to do a few more minutes here with one of our legal eagles, Quinnipiac University Law Professor Bill Dunlap. Among his areas of expertise, you know, we have him on to hash out things constitutional for us, talking about the 25th Amendment. Bill, I found it fascinating, and I actually never knew that until you mentioned it a couple of seconds ago, that the Founding Fathers and the Constitution was, would you say, it was a bit nebulous about a actual line of succession and the fact that we didn't have a vice president for a gap of time. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, actually, what the framers of the Constitution did, I don't think they were negligent. They simply left it to Congress. And Congress has at various times regulated this area in different ways. But here they decided, well, we should essentially take it out of our hands and get a standard continuing system so that we don't have to hash this out or worry about political shenanigans at a time of crisis. That's what I think was going on.
And what struck me, Bill, in your explanation of all this is how, no matter what the vice president may think or members of the cabinet, that there is this, again, built-in safety valve here, as you say, that has to, at least in some way, even in the president's defense here, has to involve members of Congress, right? I mean, it's not, you know, there has to be some input from the legislature.
Yeah, if this is going to last more than 3 weeks or so, Congress is going to have to get involved. The only exception to that is if the president does not contest it. But I don't think that's a possibility in this particular case.
And you know what? I heard in the myriad of news that we carry here on the station, Bill, I think they interviewed General Colin Powell today, and he said he actually didn't think, Bill, for either the 25th Amendment or for a quickie impeachment to keep Mr. Trump from running again in 2024. He told the interviewer that the time frame in his mind it was just too short. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's probably true. The 25th Amendment, Section 4, could be invoked very, very quickly. I don't think there's a time problem there, but there's a will problem. I don't see any indication that the vice president is willing to get involved. And since both of the routes through the 25th Amendment require the vice president, I just don't think that's going to go anywhere. I think that impeachment probably could happen. It's not entirely clear to me what the timing is going to be, but I think there would be no problem if the House of Representatives wanted to impeach before the term is up. And then when they send it to the Senate is legally obligated to deal with that issue right away. And even if it ran past the end of President Trump's term, I think that they could continue and, if they're inclined to, convict, which would be irrelevant in terms of his staying in office. But it could, if the Senate decided to, prevent him from ever holding a federal office again. And I think that's what Nancy Pelosi is most concerned with.
Now, it's interesting there that caught my ear there, Bill. You said it could prevent him from holding federal office again. Is there wiggle room there on either side or not?
Oh, absolutely. What the Constitution provides is that if a president is impeached, that there can be no further punishment than removal from office and disqualification to hold office again. So, generally speaking, removal from office is the automatic, although it's not automatic, the Senate has to decide that, but that's pretty much the automatic result if we ever get a conviction. But the Senate would have to take a separate vote by majority to strip him from the right to ever hold federal office again. So the Senate would actually have to move forward on that.
Interesting. Interesting. Bill Dunlop, Quinnipiac University, constitutional law professor, among other disciplines. Bill, as always, we thank you for your time. It's highly valued. Have a wonderful weekend, Bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paul. Always a pleasure.
Appreciate it. Professor Bill Dunlap, Quinnipiac University, teaches constitutional, criminal, national security, counterterrorism, and international law. And about your involvement in the 25th Amendment to the Constitution. Now, a lot of people may have heard that, John, over the past couple of years. Many detractors of the current president say, well, you know, he's nuts, he's crazy. Let's invoke the 25th Amendment. Aside from the political aspect of it, explain the 25th Amendment to my listeners, John, and how'd you become involved in drafting that?
Well, let me mention what's in the 25th Amendment quickly. If there was a vacancy in the office of vice president, say, resigned or was removed from office or died in office or succeeded to the presidency and left a vacancy in the vice presidency, there was no provision in the Constitution until the 25th Amendment to fill a vacancy in the vice presidency, and the 25th Amendment does that. A second gap in the Constitution was the subject of inability. What happens when a president becomes disabled? Who can declare a president disabled? Those questions were not answered at the Constitutional Convention in framing the succession provision of the amendment. The amendment says that the president can declare his own disability. He's going in for an operation, and he's going to be weak at that point. Mm-hmm. He can pass over his powers and duties to the vice president, and the vice president becomes an acting president only for the duration of the inability. And then if a president, for example, his plane went down and you couldn't locate the president or he was unconscious for some reason, the next section of the amendment says that the vice president and a majority of the cabinet, the heads of the executive departments, have the power to say a president is disabled, and in which event the vice president once again takes over as acting president only until the president is fit and ready to go again. And how did I get involved?
Yeah, and because it's amazing to me, as you tell me that was never considered, you say, by the founders? And how did you get involved in that, John?
Well, what was considered by the founders was the original succession provision, but does not explain disability. It does not explain what happens if the vice president succeeds. Is it for the rest of the term of the president, who's maybe temporarily disabled? A question was asked at the Constitutional Convention by one of the delegates, Dickinson. It was never answered. And so it was considered at the Constitutional Convention by the question, but no answers were given. How did I get involved? Mm-hmm. I was coming out of law school in 1961. I went to Fordham Law School. I was coming out of law school after Eisenhower had sustained disabilities in office in the mid and late 1950s. Mm-hmm. And I read some articles at the time from some of the clippings a college classmate gave me about Eisenhower's disability and the fact that there was a need for an amendment in the Constitution on the subject. And he was frustrated that Congress wouldn't act on it in the face of his inabilities. And so I decided when I was getting out of law school, I should write on that subject. It was interesting. I was involved in politics, so to speak, at Fordham College as a class officer. Mm-hmm. And it just interested me. And then I did an article for the Fordham Law Review. It was the last article in the issue that came out in October 63. And a month later, President of the United States died in office through assassination.
Sure.
And I had said in my article, and I had a letter in the New York Times a week before the assassination, saying the time to deal with the problem is now when we have a young, able, and healthy president. And so my article laid out the results of my research.
Mm-hmm.
And it was picked up by the newspapers. Arthur Kroc and the New York Times wrote on the weekend after the assassination that there was a recent study of the subject mentioning my article. And I then was invited to join 11 other people. A group of the American Bar Association brought together, and they had Senator Birch Bayh, who
sure.
was the chair of the Senate Subcommittee on Constitutional Amendments. I sat next to him at that meeting, and then together as a group, we talked about what should be in a constitutional amendment. And Bayh had a draft of a proposal he had introduced in Congress in December of '63. This mm-hmm. meeting is in January of '64. And we made suggestions, and he incorporated our suggestions. And I don't think I realized that at that moment we were putting together what eventually would be the 25th
wow.
Amendment to the Constitution.
Wow, that's, boy, I tell you, you've lived a long life, obviously, still going, John. But how often do you sit back and say, think about that oh, wow moment? I mean, you tell it to, obviously, family members and friends. To leave a mark on the Constitution, that's amazing. It really is.
Well, I appreciate that. I mean, I've written on the subject, books on the 25th Amendment and articles, but I really don't sit around talking about it. I mean, when people ask me questions, I'm responsive to that. I've been really fully engaged teaching at Fordham Law School about the Constitution, about conflict resolution and ethics, mm-hmm. and get engaged in trying to help students who are looking for jobs. So those are really the priorities in my life, and I was glad to have the opportunity to have a chapter in my book describing in more detail the subject of the 25th Amendment, and I would never thought of doing that the way I did it, except that it became the story of my parents' life as well.
All right, there you go. John Feerick, when we were interviewing him for his book, and we just stumbled on that little nugget about him, The Further Shore.